GFRC 101.9 FM, Kingston's campus and community radio.
Turn it up
and embrace the nonsense.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Jesse Bell, filling in this week for Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, and it covers a new residential air conditioning pilot program designed to help vulnerable residents deal with the summer heat.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. Council has approved $17,000 from the Environmental Reserve Fund to launch a residential air conditioner pilot program aimed at supporting vulnerable residents through the summer heat. The initiative stems from a motion brought forward in March directing staff to explore options for a program targeting those most at risk, particularly low-income seniors with medical conditions, as extreme heat events are expected to start in June this year. Staff returned with a proposed plan at Council's last meeting. Drawing on similar programs in Toronto, Hamilton, and Peterborough, staff recommended a one-time investment to bulk purchase air conditioning units, with approximately 35 units expected to be distributed. The program will be administered through the city's Municipal Fee Assistance Program, with eligibility limited to Kingston residents age 65 and older living on low incomes in multi-unit housing, and who have been advised by a medical professional to use air conditioning for health reasons. Councillor Connie Glenn, who originally brought forward the motion to look into the program in March, kicked off discussion on the recommendation.
As we've heard, I think, time and time again in this chamber, we're seeing the impacts of extreme heat. Hopefully, we are not going to, as Ms. Kaner mentioned, experience that this summer. However, I'm not particularly hopeful. So I'm hoping that everyone will support this. This is a modest amount of money to help out some of the most vulnerable people, and it's a pilot. It gives us an opportunity to see what kind of positive impact we can have on this situation. So right now we're looking at individuals over 65 with self-declared medical conditions to give them a little bit of relief. So I'm not going to belabor the point. I think it's fairly straightforward. I think it's a compassionate consideration for us. And hopefully we will get a bit of warmth soon. It's a little cold out there. So with that, I hope everyone will support option two. I think it's reasonable. And I think it adds benefit and help for some of the people that are going to struggle the most this summer in the heat.
Some councillors raised concerns about liability and increased utility costs, but there was broad agreement that a pilot program is worth pursuing.
If we don't have a pilot, we don't know the information, and more information is almost always better.
Council approved the program in a 12-1 vote, with Councillor Gary Osteroff opposed due to concerns about liability.
What is the liability that we are carrying? I know it's not a lot of money, but as air conditioners cool a room down, the wires get hot. And most people don't have a clue that many, many houses can't handle an air conditioner where they put them in by windows. And there is an electrical hazard created. Someone's going to be responsible. So I remain uncomfortable because it's not certain.
Staff acknowledge that demand will likely exceed supply and say the program is designed to prioritize those at highest risk. Installation support will be provided by United Way volunteers. City staff will report back in 2027 with an evaluation of the program's outcomes. Beyond this pilot, the city is still working through its broader extreme heat strategy, with an interim plan for summer 2026 expected to come to council in June. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Next up, I'll be reading a story by Michelle Dory Forrestel, the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, about public outcry from the Napanee community over the proposed high-speed rail line. Thank you, Dinah. A surge of last-minute correspondence ahead of the scheduled Tuesday, April 28th council meeting urged the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee to reject not just a proposed rail route through eastern Ontario, but the high-speed rail project itself. Dozens of emails submitted to council between Saturday, April 14th and Sunday, April 22nd show widespread opposition to the proposed Alto high-speed rail project, with many residents arguing the current debate is being framed too narrowly. While the motion before council focused on expressing support for a northern corridor option, several of the submissions pushed back on the idea that the decision should be about routing at all. Quote, "This isn't about NIMBYism or about not wanting rail and development," wrote Natalie Hebor and Joanne Hutchinson in a joint submission. Quote, "We don't want the Alto plan at all and want them to go back to the drawing board." That sentiment is echoed across multiple letters, reflecting a broader shift in the debate from opposition to specific routes to calls to reconsider the project entirely. Across the correspondence, residents repeatedly raised concerns about environmental impacts, including the disruption to wetlands and wildlife corridors, as well as potential contamination of water systems. Others point to the design of the rail corridor itself, which would be fully fenced and lack ground-level crossings, warning it could sever rural road networks and delay emergency response times. Property expropriation is another recurring concern, with several writers highlighting uncertainty for farmers and rural landowners whose property fall within proposed corridors. Cost also figures prominently. Multiple submissions question the long-term financial implications of the project, often citing its multi-billion dollar price tag, and noting that the benefits would be concentrated in major urban centers with limited value for smaller communities. Some correspondence comes from outside Greater Napanee, underscoring the regional scope of the issue. Emma Hancock, who identified herself as a Brockville resident with family ties to a local farm, urged council to reconsider its position, citing concerns about noise and environmental disruption. Others explicitly warn of economic consequences. Peggy Doran of Plainfield, Ontario, said she frequently shops in Napanee, but would reconsider that if council supports the project. Beyond the substance of the project itself, several submissions take aim at how the issue has been presented to council. In a detailed letter, Heather S. Levy, lead of, quote, Save Stone Mills, No Alto High-Speed Rail, and a member of the Coalition for Better Rail, argued that council was being asked to consider how, not if, the project could be constructed, a framing she said reflects the position of the project proponent rather than a confirmed outcome of the broader decision-making process. Levy also noted the Crown Corporation Alto has been tasked with developing the project, but does not ultimately decide whether it proceeds, a decision that rests with the federal government. Her submission also cautioned against relying on potential add-ons, such as suggestions for a trail alongside the rail corridor, to offset broader impacts, noting that key details about such proposals remain unclear. While municipalities do not have final authority over whether the project proceeds, their positions form part of the consultation process being considered at higher levels of government. Ultimately, Napanee Council voted to reject the Alto HSR proposals for both the northern and southern route. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up next, we have a story from Brenda Little of CJPE County Radio that covers the arrival of a new fire chief to Prince Edward County.
Prince Edward County has appointed Patrick Howe as the new fire chief. He has served as the interim deputy fire chief for some time and is thrilled with this new position. Chief Howe talks about his background and his view for the future. Chief Howe, where are you from originally?
I grew up in Lanark County. I went to high school in Carleton Place.
And then you joined Hydro One.
Yes.
How old were you when you did that?
So I was just finishing my master's in forestry, so I would have been about 20, 21 years old. So when I went to university, I fully intended on being a forester in the Crown Lands of Ontario. And I went to school for forestry at Lakehead and became a registered professional forester. And although my career kind of moved away from that a little bit, I've still maintained ties with that professional organization. And last week I had the chance to go up to Pembroke. We had our 69th annual AGM and conference. I was part of the organizing committee. And so it was a really cool opportunity to connect with my classmates and my peers in the forest industry, to go out to the forest and look at logging operations and what we're doing to sustainably manage our forests, hear about the amazing logging industry in the Ottawa Valley. But a really special piece for me, the conference was in Pembroke, which is where my grandfather, who's on the wall right there, was the fire chief. And so I was able to walk down to the fire hall, knock on the door and do a little bit of a tour and speak with the fire service members up there in Pembroke, go and see his picture on the wall, and it was a really cool experience.
How did you become interested in firefighting?
Firefighting has a deep history in my family. My grandfather was the fire chief of the town of Pembroke when my mother was growing up. And my uncle was a captain on base Petawawa. And so there was always a bit of the fire culture in my family. I remember when my grandfather passed away, the firefighters participating in the service, and that being a really powerful experience for me as a youngster. And then when I left home, my mother always told me to stop in at the fire hall when you move to a new town. There's always going to be somebody there to say hi and a pot of coffee on, and you'll get to know the community a little bit. And so when I did move to Prince Edward County in 2011, I stopped in and talked to Deputy Chief Rudder at the time and got my volunteer application right away and got my burn permit and all those things and a nice plastic hat for my youngster. So that's kind of where it all started for me.
What brought you to the county?
I was living in the city in Toronto when I started my work with Hydro One. It was a wonderful experience, but I grew up in rural Ontario and I was starting to miss the country. So I was given the opportunity to move to the Picton Hydro One office and that's how we started out in the county. I'd never been here before looking for a house, and so I was pleasantly surprised when we settled in at how amazing this community was. I really enjoyed not only the country piece, but also there's a nice blend of culture and amazing things to do. It's easy to entertain family and friends when they come to visit.
What do you think the challenges will be in the future?
Change seems to be the challenge in many ways, right? Our community is changing, technologies are changing, the demographics of our working population are changing, and how we work is changing. And so having a resilient organization is going to be one of our biggest challenges, and one that's able to adapt to the changes as they come without compromising and sacrificing the tradition and some of the important things that we rely on every day.
Do you have any plans for PR for the community?
Yes, is the short answer. I think public education is one of the most important things that we do in the fire service, all of our fire services across Ontario. Raising awareness around emergency planning and how to stay safe in your home is huge. And so I really want to continue what we have going on in the county right now in terms of our volunteers and full-time firefighters out in the community and sharing those public safety messages. And I see an opportunity for us to do even more of that, whether it's barbecues or participating in focus groups or conversations. I think it's a big part of what we do in keeping the community safe and maintaining a visible presence.
So I'm assuming you have a family here.
Yes. Yes. So I have a wife and three kids and teenagers in my house now, which is fun. So I have a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 16-year-old. We're pretty active in the sporting community. Baseball and hockey are our big sports. And my daughter, who's in grade 10, is pretty active on the rugby pitch, which is pretty cool with the school. And my son just was awarded a place on the varsity baseball team with Nicholson. So
nice. Yeah. Nice. What do you like to do when you're not involved with carting kids around or at the fire department? What do you like to do?
Sports are a big part of my life. I play men's hockey, coaching my children as well. In hockey and baseball, I play in the North Shore Slow Pitch League up in Ameliasburg, which is a lot of fun. And if I get time, outdoor sporting or hunting and fishing are a big part of my life if I can make that happen.
Chief Howe gives us the last word.
First and foremost, it feels like a really special opportunity, and I feel very grateful for the support of not only the volunteer and full-time firefighters and the municipal management, but the confidence that's placed in me for public safety within the community. It's a tremendous honor and a lot of responsibility that I'm not taking lightly, but it feels like a really special opportunity for me, and I'm really looking forward to working with the fire service, working with the municipal staff, and working with the community to have a positive impact, to be there when people need us, and to spread the important words around emergency planning and emergency management and what we can all do to keep ourselves and our community safe. It's a really important mission. You know, it's people always talk about you've got to have a corporate mission or a drive that means something to you. And the mission of the fire service and public safety is very important, and it's motivating for me, and it drives me to succeed. And it just feels like a really good fit, and I'm just thrilled to be part of it.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Coming up next, I'll be reading a story by Keith Dempsey, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, who presents us with a TLTI news brief. The town of Gananoque has temporarily closed the Gord Brown Memorial Canada 150 outdoor rink after significant damage to the facility's boards, with repairs expected to keep the rink out of service until late May. Town officials say the damage is extensive enough that repairs and replacement parts are needed before the rink can safely reopen to the public. The closure will remain in effect while municipal crews complete the maintenance work required to restore safe playing conditions and prevent future deterioration. According to the town, the repairs are necessary to ensure the facility can reopen safely and continue to serve residents without risking additional damage. Staff are expected to work over the coming weeks to complete the repairs, while the town will provide updates on reopening timelines and facility schedules through its website and social media channels. Municipal officials are asking residents for patience during the temporary shutdown as work continues to return the popular outdoor rink to service. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands is reminding business and property owners that applications for its Spring Community Improvement Plan grant programs close May 29th. The Township's financial incentive programs offer grants to support a variety of property improvement projects aimed at encouraging investment and enhancing the appearance and function of local properties. Eligible projects include facade improvements to commercial and mixed-use buildings, accessibility upgrades, and the creation or renovation of secondary dwelling units. Funding is also available for redevelopment, expansion, and conversion projects, along with initiatives connected to agriculture, agritourism, ecotourism, and recreational uses in rural areas. Township officials say the community improvement plan is intended to help property owners invest in improvements while supporting the broader economic development goals across the municipality. Applicants are encouraged to review program requirements and speak with planning staff about potential projects before submitting an application. Residents interested in running for municipal council will have two opportunities this spring to learn more about what the role involves, with information sessions planned in Lansdowne and Gananoque. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands will host the first session on May 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. at 1 Jesse Street in Lansdowne. A second session will be held June 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Council Chambers at Gananoque Town Hall, located at 30 King Street East. These sessions are open to anyone considering a run for municipal office and will provide information on council responsibilities, candidate eligibility requirements, and the election process. Organizers say these sessions are intended to help prospective candidates better understand the demands of public office and decide whether running for council is the right fit. Attendees will also have an opportunity to ask questions and learn more about the role local elected officials play in shaping their communities. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Over now to Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJAI Amherst Island Radio, with a story about the Amherst View Fire Department's acquisition of a new fire tanker.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJAI Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township Council pre-approved $900,000 in the 2027 capital budget for the purchase of a new tanker for the Amherst View Fire Station. They will also use nearly $85,000 from the 2026 capital budget for the down payment. Council had already approved the purchase of a new tanker for the Amherst Island Fire Station in the 2026 capital budget and were informed the tanker in Amherst View has reached the end of its useful life. With fire apparatus costs continuing to rise each year, staff noted that delaying the purchase would see an increase of at least $125,000 for 2027. Fire Chief Kent Reedman spoke about the importance of getting pre-approval.
There'll be no cost incurred this year, no additional cost incurred this year by the township. This will be all on the 2027 capital budget. So it will save $125,000 plus in next year's budget if we can do it this spring, as opposed to waiting 8 months. There's some significant price increases coming down the pipe here, and we're just trying to get ahead of it.
Councillor Mike Budarek noted the importance of trying to save money.
Just appreciate that the chief's trying to get ahead of this and save us a little money, so it's always appreciated with how tight times are these days.
Councillor Paul Proderick showed his support for the pre-approval.
$100,000 is a good savings, and given the experiences of the last few months, the value of our emergency services cannot be measured in dollars, and move ahead with this as soon as possible.
The Emergency Services Department looks to order the same tanker that was ordered for Amherst Island and remain consistent with their fleet for the next 20 to 25 years. The two old tankers will be sold and are expected to generate nearly $75,000. This will be applied to the fleet reserve for future apparatus purchases. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Coming up next, we have CFRC's Sports Report. The 2026 CFL entry draft was held last Tuesday night in Toronto. The draft's top prospect, Akeem Mezidor, saw his draft stock plummet after being selected in the first round of the NFL draft by the Los Angeles Chargers. Mezidor's NFL commitments opened the door for some other elite Canadian university prospects to climb the rankings. Ultimately, it was Winnipeg-born offensive lineman Giordano Vaccaro who heard his name called first by the Ottawa Redblacks. Vaccaro began his football career with the University of Manitoba Bison before transferring to the NCAA's Purdue Boilermakers. A compact, powerful player, Vaccaro will have an opportunity to start on day one for the 4-14 Ottawa Redblacks. With the second pick in the 2026 draft, the Toronto Argonauts took the first U Sports player off the board, selecting Queens tackle Nicholas Hennig. This second overall selection capped off a meteoric rise for Hennig, who just 2 years earlier was not viewed as a viable pro prospect. In 2024, Hennig made the switch from H-back to tackle and proved to be a revelation for the Gaels, racking up two all-OUA selections and an all-Canadian nod. A remarkable athlete, scouts fell in love with his long, strong frame and quick feet. Hennig is the highest-drafted Queens Gaels player since 2010, when standout linebacker Shamari Williams was picked by Saskatchewan with the first overall pick in that draft. Hennig also accepted NFL minicamp invites from the Indianapolis Colts and the Las Vegas Raiders. Quebec's Daniel Jabome was the first offensive player off the board, going third overall to the Edmonton Elks. Jabome had a productive four-year career with Rutgers in the NCAA, distinguishing himself as an excellent tackler with an underrated ability to rush the quarterback. The rest of the first round played out as expected, with a number of NCAA athletes taken in rapid succession. We'll pick things up in the fourth round, where Queens linebacker Justin Pace was drafted 35th overall. A multiple-time all-conference player for the Gaels, Pace turned in a solid combine performance, which, combined with 3 seasons of elite play, helped him rise up draft boards. He will join former defensive battery mates Silas Hubert, Olivier Mwembe, and Darian Newell in the green and gold. The Calgary Stampeders would complete the tricolor trifecta in the seventh round with the selection of defensive lineman Stephen Kapaia. Though Kapaia is undersized for his position, he possesses an impressive array of speed, rush, moves, and a sideline-to-sideline level of athleticism. Kapaia joins fellow Yates Cup champion Ashton Miller-Melançon in Cowtown. Though the 62nd overall pick will have his work cut out for him to make the day one roster, adversity is nothing new for this young man who began his life in a refugee camp fleeing a civil war. Regardless of where his football career goes, it's been one remarkable journey for the man known as Scary Steve. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up next, we have the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. This is your Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Tuesday, May 5th, 15 is your high with a 91% chance of rain, and that will cool things off quite a bit heading into the overnight, dropping down to just 6 degrees. Wednesday, May 6th, chillier day here in the city of Kingston, daytime high of 8 with a 64% chance of precipitation. Thursday, May 7th, 9 is your high, and believe it or not, more rain in the forecast, a 60% chance of rain here in the city of Kingston, going to feel closer to 5 degrees, so quite chilly. Friday, May 8th, a little bit of sunshine, but still about a 65% chance of precipitation in the afternoon, 8 degrees your high. Moving into the second weekend in May, Saturday, May 9th, 10 degrees, sunny. But once again, a 55% chance of rain in the forecast, and that remains consistent into Sunday, May 10th. 11 degrees is your high, partly sunny with a little bit of rain in the afternoon. And then kicking off the start of next week, Monday, May 11th, 12 degrees is your high, mostly sunny with a mix of cloud.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Combinations, a fully self-produced one-man band release from Plune. Written, performed, and produced entirely by the artist, the track blends the experimental spirit of Beck with a raw, stripped-down folk rock edge reminiscent of Neil Young. Learn more about the artist and keep up with the latest by following them at Plune Music on Instagram. And if you're a local musician who would like airplay and social media coverage on our channels, complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit at kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Combinations by Plune on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
and welcome to GradChat, your opportunity to find out about graduate student research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host of this week's GradChat. This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to find out all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are currently working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Sarvanas Hirani Mogadam, who is doing her PhD in kinesiology under the supervision of Drs. Aaron Cressman and Dr. Jerome Manson. Welcome to GradChat, Sarv.
Hi, Katie Marie. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm really looking forward to learning about your research. But at first, I was just curious, why did you choose Queen's in the first place?
I'm really excited to be here, and I chose Queen's mostly because of Jerome's research. Mm. I've always been really fascinated with how people move in general. Like, we can make all these really, you know, routine movements to pick up our water bottles or pick up our coffee cups. And even though this seems very simple, when things go wrong in the background, like our, you know, if somebody has a stroke, for example, or with Parkinson's disease, these really simple movements become really difficult. Mm. And Jerome's research really digs into this from different aspects. So I wanted to come to Queen's to get to work with him. And I'm also co-supervised with Dr. Aaron Cressman, who does similar research at University of Ottawa.
Oh, very cool. So you are a PhD student at both Queen's and the University of Ottawa.
Yes. Yeah, they've been incredible. They're very supportive of me and my projects, and the whole journey has been great.
Oh, good. So I'm glad to hear that. So you mentioned a lot about movement there, but can you tell us specifically about what your PhD topic is all about?
Yeah. So in regards to that, I look at how people learn movement patterns, and just I like to kind of make it relatable a little bit at the beginning before I get into the specifics. So
thank you, because I am not an expert in this field whatsoever. So. Yeah.
So if you can think about, like, humans who go to space, for example, or go underwater really deep, and we're still able to kind of use tools and be able to be accurate in different environments. So in space, for example, there's different gravity than what we're used to on Earth. And underwater, there's different visual information that we have to deal with in order to use different tools. And the human body and the brain is able to control those types of movements and help us, you know, get the task that we want to get done. I don't do research in space or underwater, but I use robotics and virtual reality to be able to kind of simulate different novel visual information for people and watch how they move. Essentially, looking at their reaching movements and look at kinematics such as position of your hand, velocity, acceleration, stuff like that. So I have an example that everyone can relate to. So if you ever, like, you're using your own computer and you're used to kind of you moving the mouse around and you know how fast the mouse moves and where things are on your screen, you're pretty comfortable with that. But if you switch to your friend's computer and maybe they have different mouse settings or something.
Oh, that is awful, right? And the keyboard's slightly different. Everything's just a little off.
Yeah, everything's a little off, but you get used to it really quickly, right? Like, so my research has to do a lot with that, of how do we adapt in novel environments like that? Like, how is the brain able to make adjustments or help us make those adjustments to our fine movements to be able to be accurate in using another person's computer? Yeah, so.
Oh, that sounds really cool. So when you test this and look at how people adapt, are you looking at a certain population of people? Are you working with a wide population? What are your participants look like, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Right. So a lot of research in our area, obviously there's a clinical side, but I'm more on the healthy young population.
Okay.
Because the idea is to kind of understand the healthy nervous system and the healthy brain before we can actually apply this to the clinical population. So a lot of all of my participants for my PhD and for my master's, they've been healthy young adults, and they come in and they kind of essentially help us learn about or help us add to the literature of how does the healthy brain move in novel environments. And then this can be a foundation for rehabilitation programs and even coaching and instructional programs or even curriculum for medical training and dentistry training and stuff like that. Because if you think about, for example, certain surgeries that are done using new technologies and robotics, mm-hmm. and also dentists every day, they use mirrors, for example, to kind of get into people's mouths and mm-hmm. Be in different angles, and they have to go through certain training. So my research sort of can be applied to any of these areas because it's a fundamental research, looking at the healthy mm-hmm. nervous system and how people move in novel environments. So it can have different applications.
Oh, very cool. So it sounds like there's a wide variety of ways some of your findings can be used by other researchers or other clinicians or other practitioners in the future. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you do virtual reality environments. So when a participant comes to work with you, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. So that's a really good question, because I found, with data collection, if participants hadn't been in the area mm-hmm. or hadn't been in the room, they would be a little, curious and almost nervous to be, mm-hmm. You're working with something new. You're already in a new environment. But I mean, most of my participants were graduate students or undergraduate students who were in the university already. So essentially when participants come in, they go through the consent form. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of forms that they have to fill out, just like any other human.
Yes, any study, of course, study. Yes.
And then I get them introduced to the kin arm. So the kin arm is the main robot that I use, or equipment that I use for my data collection. It's essentially you are seated on a chair, and then the setup is there's a TV that's facing down.
Okay.
And then there's a mirror underneath this TV that essentially reflects what's on the TV on the mirror or the reflective surface. Mm-hmm. And that's where the visual information is given to participants.
Okay.
And then the participants are in the chair. Their arms are in troughs. It's kind of like a robot exoskeleton.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, that is holding onto their hand, their lower arm, and their upper arm. And then I push them forward so their forehead kind of rests on the TV mm-hmm. and their eyes are looking at the reflective surface. And what's interesting about this setup is that you can think of changing people's visual informations maybe by giving them prism goggles, right? Mm-hmm. So giving people prism goggles already sort of tells them, oh, something may change in my environment, in my visual environment. And this is what's the difference between having prism goggles or doing studies with prism goggles versus the kin arm, is because when you have someone in the kin arm, so now their hands are in troughs, they're in that environment, they're not able to see their hands. Mm-hmm. And they actually they don't know what they're going to see on the screen. Mm, or mm-hmm. I have told them a little bit about, you're going to make reaching movements, you're going to go to the target, there's going to be targets on the screen that you have to reach to. But otherwise, the manipulation that we're going to give to them can stay below conscious awareness. That becomes really important for my study. Because, earlier studies that were looking at this, how does the brain go through and process this novel environment or novel mm-hmm. visual motor environment is what we call it.
Okay.
The fancy word is yes. visual motor, but it's just visual and movement mm-hmm. together. So visual motor was using prism goggles. But that, again, this component of it being a conscious thing that happened, I'm putting prism goggles on, I see my visual field shift. Mm-hmm. It's something that's important for my study that, participant, this thing doesn't become conscious for participants unless if they, figure something out during the study.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully, I think by this point, by the time the show airs, you've collected all of your data with participants, so there's no spoilers
exactly.
for future participants if they,
yeah, exactly.
if anyone is coming to know that they yeah. don't know that you have yeah. altered the perception that they may be seeing a little bit to influence your data.
Exactly. I'm actually done data collection.
Congratulations.
Yes. So, currently done, yeah. I'm almost done my first paper, too, at this point.
Oh, very nice.
Almost.
Okay. That is exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that takes a lot of work. And it sounds like from the way you have so many different inputs, right, with the kin arm, it sounds like you've got, if I'm understanding this correctly, where people's arms are in the trough of the robot kind of guiding them. You're collecting data from all of these different points, from the kin arm, from eye movements that you're tracking, and from what the participant is seeing and what they're doing, what they're reaching. How do you work with all of these, I assume, thousands and thousands of data points? How do you work with all of this mm-hmm. data?
Honestly, I wish I had the time and the capacity to collect all of that data. I actually mm-hmm. don't have eye movement data. That would be really interesting.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And there have been studies that have used eye movement data. I only look at the index finger. Okay. So I'm very interested in like seeing like where the index finger is relative to the visual information that are on the screen. So if I want to tell you a little bit more like specifics about my study is that, so now the participant is in the KinArm, they're all set up, there's a calibration process, and the KinArm collects data at 1,000 hertz. So I get 1,000 samples per second.
Wow. Well, you said I don't even collect that much data. That sure sounds like a lot of data to work with from to me.
Yeah, and for my PhD, I have tested upwards of 200 people.
Wow.
Yeah, so over 4 experiments. Oh. So it is.
So you have a lot of data. You're being humble. You have a ton of data to work with.
So yeah, I have participants. Essentially, it's a very simple movement. It's you move from a home position, it's a white home position, and there's a target. And all you have to do is to get this pink cursor that's on the screen to the target. And you have to make shooting movements. So you're in the home position, the target shows up, and you have to shoot and slice through the target to get this pink cursor to the target.
Right?
Okay. And at the beginning, it's really important to get a sense of where participants are in terms of this movement at baseline to understand any biomechanical differences or biomechanical biases that they might have. So they go through this baseline process and we kind of see that a lot of people are very good at this. So they get this pink cursor to the target, they're very accurate, and they finish this baseline phase. And then where the manipulation comes in is this training phase. So my main research question had to do with this idea of a mirror-versed feedback. There has been a lot of studies using a rotated visual feedback, which I'll describe in a second. But with my PhD project, I was really interested in if the brain can kind of take this mirror transformation. So essentially where the mirror-versal is that in your midline, there's a mirror-versal that is going to happen where when your hand goes to the right, you see this pink cursor or the pink feedback go to the left. So understanding this difference, are we able to kind of learn this transformation, and is it similar to a rotated visual feedback? So a rotated visual feedback is very similar, but it's a consistent change. So we're able to kind of program. So I program just a 20 degree difference between where the hand is and where the cursor is for the rotated visual feedback. So this is just rotated. It's always going to be 20 degrees. And because it's small, it stays below conscious awareness. So
people don't realize, they just adjust automatically to the rotated version. They don't know that they're doing it necessarily, but they just account for it, and the brain goes forward and the hand goes where it should according to what the brain's taking in. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I used a lot of that literature in the kind of the rotated visual feedback. There's been a lot of work done on the rotated visual feedback stuff, and then try and apply it or try and learn a bit more about this mirror-versal. So we tried to keep this mirror-versal small also. The studies that had done studies with this mirror-versal feedback had used a large distortion. So they put this, so essentially you have to put the targets very strategically from the y-axis to then get a certain degree of distortion essentially from your hand movement. And previous studies had put these targets really far from the y-axis. So you get this like either 45 degree or a 90 degree difference between where your hand goes and where they see the feedback. So we thought, okay, why don't we put the targets closer to the y-axis and then see if we try and keep this distortion small. So your hand goes to the target, you see this cursor go 20 degrees away from your hand, or 10 degrees essentially from the y-axis. Because the target would be 10 degrees to the right of the y-axis. So you get this like 20 degree difference between your hand motion and the feedback. And whether, you know, participants, are they learning it in a similar manner? Can they learn it in a similar manner? And then whether, so then it's important for me to also explain conscious and unconscious processes that help us learn these two. So maybe I backtrack a little bit. So in the visual motor rotation literature, so essentially like you described it really beautifully where you said, you know, when participants reach with that 20 degree rotated visual feedback, it stays below conscious awareness. Yes, like participants reach to it. And the way we test that is we take the visual feedback away. So there's a target and they reach to the target. But after this learning phase, they're still reaching deviated from the target, even though they're asked, you know, they're asked to reach to the target. They're still going, you know, sideways or offset.
That little 20, they're still going that 20% that they just learned.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, they're still going. So that tells us, you know, even if you're asked to go to the target, the motor system is still doing or still kind of preoccupied with the what it did before, where the feedback was 20 degrees.
Takes a little while to catch up and remember how to readjust, I guess, or remember where you're going now without this kind of manipulation or intervention. Is that
exactly?
Yeah, okay.
And this is called an after effect. So you do go through this visual motor rotated trials, and you get this after effect. So after effects are implicit or unconscious in nature. And a lot of literature in motor learning have been thinking that everything in motor learning is implicit. But more recently, we know that not conscious processes also teach us about movement, right? Like, for example, conscious processes are more strategic. Those are the instructions that you receive when you're learning something new. Or even if you're not learning something new, you're using pre-existing movements that you know, and you're just making adjustments to it.
An example be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like when you're driving a car and you're used to applying a certain amount of pressure to the gas pedal in your car, and then you drive a friend's car and you go to apply the same, but then you're consciously being like, oh, I'm not going as fast as I think I would. So you increase. Would that be an example of conscious?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. That's definitely a really good example of the conscious process. So then I try and kind of measure these things. So I measure conscious and unconscious processes when participants start adapting or learning in these novel environments, be it a rotated visual feedback or a mirror-verse feedback.
Okay. Yeah. So that sounds like, as you said before, you mentioned some different applications, but it sounds like you said, it's fundamental research. So it just helps us understand a lot of different things, and then how other people take it is up to them. So what are some areas that you think could really benefit from the findings from your work so far?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this work is really, like, it's really rooted in psychology as well. Like some of these conscious processes that we look at are called awareness. So awareness of changes in your reaches, and also kind of planning your movement. So pre-planning a movement. So a lot of the work that we do has to do like with psychology as well. But in terms of application, like, I think I've been watching a lot of volleyball recently. Like the Volleyball Nations League is going on right now. It's in the summer of 2025. And I just keep going back to one coach. This is Iran's coach, Roberto Piazza. He's been really good at, like, in volleyball, they get really short amounts of time when they take a timeout during a game, like during a really, like, intense game. And he's able to use instructions or words that really sticks with these players. Like, so my work, you know, I use a lot of instructions to ask people to, you know, for example, use a strategy they learned, and then that kind of comes out in their movement. So strategy use, or like instruction giving, is probably like one of the applications of my work. How to give instructions, or like how to, if someone's learning something new, or if they're coming back to a sport, how do we keep them engaged? Or if somebody, you know, for example, if you have an injury, for example, or you go to the physio, people usually tend to go back to physios that give good instructions, right? Or, you know, you can relate to their instructions and stuff like that. So a lot of it has to do with instruction giving, and how do we use instruction to drive some of this learning. I think that's one of the applications of rehab and coaching.
Yeah,
and
it sounds like there's a ton of, I mean, and rehab is so broad, like so many people need help recovering or relearning or learning new ways to be after, you know, a change in their health. So not just rehab for athletes, which comes to my mind first, but rehab for all sorts of people, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that is exciting to see. And so what made you interested then in this research in the first place?
So it actually goes way back, and I maybe didn't know this when I first started grad studies, but now I'm finishing up my PhD and starting to reflect on the journey and thinking kind of what got me interested is, so my grandfather actually had Parkinson's disease. And this was, now I think he was diagnosed with it more than 20 years ago. And it was in Iran, and I remember he had diabetes for a very long time, and when his motor symptoms started showing up, like, for example, one symptom is freezing of gait. When you're walking, like, you kind of freeze, like when you're like in the middle of your walk.
Like mid-step kind
of kind of thing, okay. Yeah. And his doctors were really confused. They were like, wait, we've been treating your cardiovascular system for so long. Like, what's going on with the motor system? Like, and I just remember it being a time where his doctors weren't sure what was happening, and he started showing tremors as well. So he was, like, his hands were shaking when he was trying to reach for stuff. And, you know, shortly after he passed away. So I've always been really interested in the motor system and how we move, to then be able to apply it to the clinical population. And it comes from a very personal background. And yeah, and I mean, my PhD hasn't been working with Parkinson's patients directly, but again, like, a lot of this fundamental work can be applied to clinical populations. And yeah, my next step for my postdoc is going to be working with people with stroke, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even though, I mean, fundamental research is so important, right, because it helps everyone, but then you're going to be, you personally will be transitioning from a more fundamental research to a more applied research area. Oh, that's very exciting. And we are recording in the summer, but when, what, where will you be headed for your postdoc?
I'm actually going to be going to UBCO in Kelowna.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Okay, so the University of British Columbia, Okanagan?
Yes.
Oh, very nice. Okay.
Yeah. And that's in probably starting in January.
But okay.
We will see about that.
Yes. Finish the PhD first, exactly. Get it off of your plate, and then you can look forward. Yeah. Oh, that's exciting. Mm-hmm. So you have been up to many, many things, it sounds like, throughout this project. Well, doing four studies with over 200 participants and working across two universities with two supervisors. You sound like you've been up to a lot in the research arena, but I've heard that you've also been involved with some research activities in whatever spare time you have left. So what have you been doing at Sheridan College?
Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. So at Sheridan College, I'm an external board member on their research ethics board.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, so I get to see and review some of their applications that come in through their REB or research ethics board. And it's been really interesting. And I work with, you know, they have their whole team. Like, we do full board meetings and we get delegated reviews sometimes, like, depending on what areas of research we're interested in. Mm-hmm. And I just, since my master's, I just find the ethics process really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my colleagues don't. So yeah, I'm always the one, you know, reading the consent forms and like going through different parts of their applications just to make sure they're hitting all the different steps. And I find it really interesting. And yeah, and recently I was at a conference in Toronto at York University where somebody was talking about neuroethics. So kind of bridging the gap between kind of neuroscience, that's my background, and kind of the nervous system and like the brain data versus ethics. Like, how is brain data used in different parts of the world, like in courtrooms and stuff like that? And what are the boundaries of that? Which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I never thought like I would be the person who would say, you know, I really like the ethics boards and like like thinking about these things, like what needs to be included in consent forms when you're testing human beings and like, you know,
no, that's
like
really
that.
Important work. So how did you get involved with that at Sheridan College?
Yeah, I was going to say that right now, like my friend Laura, shout out to Laura, actually. She's incredible. She graduated from her PhD from U Ottawa in the same area as me, like looking at motor learning, I think 2 years ago now. And she's been working at Sheridan College as their head of research. So and she's also part of the REB. Yeah, so she got me. I was talking with her about her new job and how things are going. And she was like, hey, like, we're looking for external board members. Like, if you're interested, you can sit on the board and stuff like that. And I thought about it. I was like, that's actually pretty cool. And these meetings are completed online. So even though I'm in Kingston, I can still join their meetings online, because Sheridan has three campuses, but this one, I think, so they have an Oakville campus, there's one in Hamilton, I think, so yeah, this is them, their main campus.
Oh, very nice. So that's really cool to see you taking your work and your interest in ethics specifically in other totally different contexts and helping out other researchers at Sheridan College and in other places to continue this discussion about what is ethical in research and how should we work with people when we want to work with them. Oh, that is fascinating stuff. And, well, thank you for doing all that, because the research community needs people to help each other, because otherwise, who would do that work, right? So it's great to have, I think, up-and-coming emerging scholars contributing to these discussions and kind of steering where discussions of ethics go in the future. Because, as you said, not everyone is interested in ethics or maybe even scared of ethics is maybe the right way to say it. I know some people are afraid to apply because they just don't know, but opening those conversations is really important. And outside of this, I also hear that you are enjoying many different sports and activities. So what are you currently up to activity-wise?
You know, being a kitten student and all, like the stereotype. I have been, like, recently I've just been enjoying volleyball a
very
lot.
Very nice, okay.
Yeah. And still, like, I'm still doing triathlon training, like swim, bike, run. That's, like, where I just decompress and like I just find that I sleep a lot better with sports, so like that's my main reason. I'm like, okay, if I'm active during the day, I'm able to sleep, and that just helps me the next day as well. So yeah, swimming, biking, running.
Are you preparing for any races currently?
Currently, no. I have a bunch of volleyball tournaments.
Oh, very nice.
Up.
Okay.
Yeah, but a race, I think I'm gonna do the Niagara half marathon or something.
Oh, wow.
Probably that's in October. But yeah, I did a half Ironman last year. Yeah, and that was really, really fun.
That sounds fun is one word for it, but challenging perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool. But I just found, you know, with trying to push to finish the PhD, I just did not have enough time to put into triathlon or the Ironman training. But last week I did a trail race. I did a 10K trail race in Milton. It was really cool. It was like the terrain was everything that you could imagine. There was like, there were rocks, there were small rocks and big rocks, and you would go uphill, and then like the first 5K was uphill, and then you would come back same way. Yeah. It was really, really good. Like it was a hot day too, but it was over because it was only a 10K. Like it was quick.
Only a 10K. Well,
Your perspective changes.
I guess so. Yes, if you've done the half Ironman and things like that. But how do you find? You mentioned that it helps you sleep, but how do you find balancing the activities that you enjoy, like volleyball, running, swimming, and all of this research and other volunteer work that you're doing? How are you able to balance all of these things at once?
So I find that I'm able to be my best self and my best research self if I am active during the day, you know? Like, I'm able to show up for those long riding hours. Like if I either have something during lunch, like I can look forward to, like either a swim, go for a swim during lunch, or I go for a run after work or something like that, just to, you know, just to do something else. And because I do a lot of, like, I understand kind of human anatomy and ergonomics. I actually taught a course at Queen's in ergonomics.
Oh, very cool.
So yeah, even like sitting at a desk, I'm constantly aware of, like, you know, my posture, and like maybe I've been sitting for too long and things start hurting, and I know that if I don't move, I'm gonna hurt, like it's just gonna hurt more the next day. So in order to sit longer, I need to like move as well. So it kind of goes hand in hand, I think, everything I do. And then with when I do volunteer work at Sheridan, that's really fulfilling. And also I feel like the part where I can apply what I've learned to an actual, like a research board, then I can contribute.
Yeah.
Kind of thinking about different systems that they have at their RAB, that I find that really fulfilling. So I think the whole, it's like a cycle for me. It's like, okay, I have to do like, yeah, this many hours of writing, or I have this to-do list to get done, but can I be in a better headspace for it? And can I do less staring at my screen and more like productive work if I actually get up and do something and then come back to it?
No, I think that's a really great lesson to remember, because sometimes when you're, especially when you're at the end and you're in this writing phase, you end up just sitting at your desk or sitting at a coffee shop or sitting in the library for hours on end. And like you said, sometimes you're just staring at the screen, right? And maybe it's a good time to, that's maybe your body trying to tell you that it's time to take a break and come back to this later. And I don't think your brain ever stops thinking about your dissertation until you're done. So even when you're out enjoying activities, I'm sure your subconscious is writing your thesis for you.
Exactly.
In the background, it's making those connections and it's making those pieces come together so that when you do come back to write, you're ready to go. And you've made some progress.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Sarv. It has been wonderful chatting with you. Thank you so much for sharing all of your work, and good luck with the rest of your PhD as you start to wrap up and work on your papers. And hopefully we will get a chance to chat with you maybe as you start your postdoc work in the future. We'll see. Hopefully we can have you back for another episode.
Definitely, yeah. This has been a treat.
Oh, it's been a treat to have you here as well. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget that you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. Live music fans, get ready. Spring Reverb returns for its fifth edition May 28th through the 31st in downtown Kingston, Ontario, and CFRC is thrilled to be part of the action. Over 4 days, you can catch live music panels, workshops, and see what makes the Kingston music scene tick. Get ready for acts like Bedouin Soundclash, The Dirty